This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org. Stay tuned for a farm and garden show with J. Allison Moscariello and Bill Taylor. We will discuss Landrace Gardening, a book by Joseph Lofthouse about breeding locally adapted crops and maintaining seed vigor and quality. First, some upcoming events. The Great Barrington Seed Library needs a coordinator to revive this community resource. Contact the Great Barrington Public Library at 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Once again, 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Berkshire-grown Winter Farmers Market is in Housatonic, third Saturday of the month, from 10 to 2 at the Housie Dome, 1061 Main Street, Housatonic, from now through April. BerkshireGrown.org for more information. SNAP and HIP benefits are doubled up to $25 per week. The Sheffield Winter Farmers Market takes place at Dewey Hall on the second Saturday of the month until March, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. March 9th at Dewey Hall, 91 Main Street, Sheffield, Mass. Millerton, New York Farmers Market is at 6 Duchess Avenue, Millerton Methodist Church, on the second and fourth Saturdays now through April, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. SNAP accepted, FMNP accepted, FCC accepted. Williamstown Farmers Market is the third Saturday from 9 to noon through April. First Congregational Church, 906 Main Street, Williamstown. Pittsfield Farmers Market is the second Saturday through April from 9 to 1 at Zion Lutheran Church, 74 First Street in Pittsfield. Berkshire Botanical Garden in Stockbridge offers many classes on gardening, horticulture, cooking, and other garden-related topics. The website berkshirebotanical.org/events has listings. Phone is 413-298-3926. Email is info@berkshirebotanical.org. Again, the phone for the Botanical Garden is 413-298-3926. The Mass College of Liberal Arts in North Adams has Green Living Seminars every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. through April 11th at 375 Church Street in North Adams. For more information, mcla.edu/mcla-in-the-community. That's mcla.edu/mcla-in-the-community.
Joseph Lofthouse wrote Landrace Gardening, Food Security Through Biodiversity and Promiscuous Pollination. He developed Landrace Gardening in response to harsh growing conditions in a high altitude, short season desert garden. Instead of relying on expensive poisons, labor, and materials to coddle the plants, he encourages genetic diversity, cross-pollination, and survival of the fittest, allowing the plants to adapt themselves to the current and ever-changing ecosystem, thus simplifying gardening and seed saving. Joseph loves eating, farming, swimming, hot springs, sunbathing, bird watching, running, yoga, leggings, kilts, playing guitar, singing, and living habitually barefoot. Are you our brother?
Might be.
Yeah, I think you are. So let me ask you a very basic question to start us out. How long have you been gardening and seed saving?
Well, I grew up on the family farm that had been in the family for 160 years, and so my whole life. But about 15 years ago, I got really serious and said that I was going to grow all of my own seeds.
Ooh.
Wow.
That was a pretty good thing to do. Considering the beautiful book that you came out with, we're glad you did that.
Thank you.
So you started doing that, and how did that work out?
Really good, because all of a sudden I was saving thousands of dollars a year from my seed costs, and my crops were growing more reliably than they ever had before. So eventually I converted like 100 species to my own varieties that were local to my farm, so that my garden could really thrive then.
Great.
That's fantastic.
So many of our listeners buy seeds to plant or they buy seedlings raised by others. What are the benefits and drawbacks of doing it that way?
Well, the benefit of buying plants that somebody else has grown for you is that it is super easy, it's fast, it's satisfying because you can go out in one day and you can have your whole garden planted. The disadvantage of that is the plants often suffer transplant shock. They take a long time to get going, and those plants might have persistent insecticides on them that can last your whole growing season. It has its benefits and its not so good things about it.
Also, it's more expensive. You're buying someone else's labor.
Yes, exactly.
I've done some seed saving myself, and I think some of our listeners maybe have too. And I have usually avoided saving seeds from groups of crops that cross a lot, that are more promiscuous, that don't stay true to type. Most people doing seed saving and advising about it and writing books about it said, you want to make sure things are true to type and you want to have certain isolation distances. And certainly there are times that one, even you might want to do that. But what are the problems doing that?
Well, what ends up happening is our crops end up being inbred. And when they get inbred, they lose vigor and they don't grow very well. We're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot by always continuously inbreeding our crops.
I was saying to someone, it's like marrying your cousin.
Exactly. Because these little weird things show up and then the next generation, they show up a little bit more. And before you know it, your whole crop's all weirded out. I think a lot of those rules about seed savings are actually some kind of propaganda by the seed companies so that we don't dare save our own seeds and we always have to buy seeds from the company every year. And I think that enters into it as well.
I just want to say that I find it remarkable because it's in so many ways, it's simple. Save your seeds. I just remember having that feeling. Oh, you can't save your own seeds. You said it's been propagandized. We've been brainwashed a little bit.
I believe so too, because if we look at the history of agriculture, every variety that I am currently growing was developed by illiterate plant breeders. They knew nothing about genetics, isolation distances, and yet they developed every variety that I'm currently growing. Wow. And so if they can do it, so can we.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think also about the historical archaeological discoveries where they found seed that's been buried under for a long time, perhaps in a little casket, and they're still viable after generations, hundreds and hundreds of years. So it's fascinating. So I love the title of your book and Landrace Gardening. I just want you to know that there was a little confusion for me when I heard Landrace Gardening. So can you let our listeners know what exactly is a landrace?
I define landraces as locally adapted, promiscuously pollinated, and community selected food crops. Because of the high genetic diversity, they adapt to ever-changing and challenging local conditions.
Mm-hmm. So these are races of plants that belong to the land that we grow on.
Exactly. Because they've lived there so long and got so well adapted that they're part of the local community, part of the local ecosystem. And because they are local, they can really adapt well to changing conditions.
So are a lot of the plants that you're growing have come from the other farmers and the community that you live in and generations beyond? They've been passed down?
It's not easy to get genetically diverse crops. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up making my own landraces in a lot of cases. And I also collaborate closely with nearby farmers and further away farmers so that I can get that genetic diversity. But eventually it has to come to my garden or my valley and really select for what thrives here.
Yeah.
So somebody in our area, say, or whoever listening, wherever you are, how would they get started doing the landrace? And there's a lot of details that which we're going to dive into.
There's two different ways that I recommend for starting a landrace. The first is just incrementally. grow whatever crop you normally grow and plant something else next to it. If you happen to like the something else and it shares pollen with your crop that you've been growing for a long time, then beautiful. You know, save the seeds from that and see where it goes from there. The other way you can do is you could plant five varieties together and allow them to promiscuously cross-pollinate, and then select out of those what you want to continue on to future years.
Your book has a chart. It shows roughly what the crossing is for each different kind of species. So with beans or lettuce, it might be harder to get them to cross than it might be for, say, squash or melons.
Right. I highly recommend starting with the crops that are known to be outcrossing, because you can get much quicker results than if you're trying to work with the mostly inbreeding crops.
Now, this is the opposite of what they say. You save the easy ones that don't cross. You're saying start with the ones that do cross, because you'll be able to get that diversity to propagate through generations more quickly and find some varieties that might work better for you, right?
Right. And so especially things like corn and spinach and any of the melons or squash, they are really susceptible to cross-pollination, so they can get locally adapted really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I have found is that the ecosystem does about 80% of the selection for me. And so I don't have to really fuss with selecting for what varieties will grow well here, because the ecosystem just takes care of that.
I like that you put in your book, you talk about the magical year being year three. In the first year, you say the maladapted plants, you're planting all kinds of things in the first year, your maladapted plants will die out. That's eliminating you doing all the work of trying to figure things out. In the second year, you assert that the survivors cross-pollinate. And then you say the third year is the magical year, where the plants have had already 2 years of local adaptation and selection for greatness. Has that continued to be true for you? This it sounds so wonderful and easy.
It is. And that's my general observation over all species that I've grown over all time. I do grow some species that are really difficult for my ecosystem, like the watermelon.
Yeah.
And I'm maybe 10 generations into the watermelon, and they've never reached that magical state because they're just too far outside of their comfort zone. But other crops like the muskmelons and the squashes and corn adapt super easy for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you were talking about a bumper crop of the muskmelons.
Yes, in my third year, the first year I planted muskmelons, cantaloupes, maybe 80% of them died or didn't produce fruit. The second year, there were two plants that produced more fruit than 200 other plants.
Wow.
And so then the third year, I was just harvesting bushels and bushels and bushels of cantaloupes. And eventually, because I'm tasting every fruit before I save seeds from it, I ended up with cantaloupes that were so flavorful and so odoriferous that I started calling them muskmelons, because they seem like something totally different than the cantaloupes that the store sells.
Wow. Okay, Bill, we got to take note of this, because we've got to do this. We both love melons.
Watermelons are hard here. I took seeds I grew in California and planted them here. And I think I got a watermelon that was 2 inches wide, was the biggest I got. So I'm kind of ready to give up on them, but I might try again. Take all our watermelon seeds, just throw them in and see if any of them make it. But I probably have to get them from around here.
What area are you growing in, Bill?
Well, we're in Massachusetts. My wife calls it the Siberia of Massachusetts, or maybe her sister
calls it the Siberia.
Because we're at 1,600 feet, and the valleys are just 5 degrees warmer, and they can do things there we can't do up here.
Right.
Maybe like zone 5B, which isn't maybe as cold as you, but it's cold enough, and we have a shorter warm season. We have more clouds in the summer, so not as long a growing season.
And we have surprise frosts that show up just to let them
mid-May.
Let us know that they're thinking of us.
Uh-huh.
You talked about how the ecosystem takes care of things. I think you're alluding to survival of the fittest. And I was wondering if you're familiar with Mark Shepard's Restoration Agriculture author and his idea of mass plantings of perennial crops and his stun maintenance idea, sheer total utter neglect. I just wanted you to talk about your method of growing things and how you get such good results.
Right. So I am familiar with Mark Shepard's work. Him and I had a conversation about a couple months ago on my podcast. And I really love everything about his sheer total utter neglect, because that's the same sort of system that I adapted, not knowing about him ahead of time. And the one thing that I like particularly about his method is he's working with trees. And trees, people say, oh, you can't breed trees because it takes 15 years between generations, and blah, blah. And Mark says that the thing that he selects for on the trees is precocious fruiting. So he wants them to be fruiting in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, so that he can do a ton of generations during his lifetime. And I really agree with that. Other things that Mark and I share in common is I haven't put fertilizer onto my fields in the last 15 years. No. I don't put compost or mulches. I do hardly any weeding because I want the plants to be able to thrive in the ecosystem exactly as it exists without me always putting labor and chemicals and materials to try to coddle the plants.
You sound like a true permaculturist, you know, because they're all about, let the plants do the work. I'm just going to show up and get the food.
Yeah.
The one thing that surprised me the most about my message is that the permaculturists really resonate with it. They beat me up a little bit because I till my garden sometimes, oftentimes. And so there's that disconnect there.
Well, that whole thing about tillage, it can become a religion to do no-till. We had a fire in California and we had certain things came in, watercress, miner's lettuce, and the berries all came in so much better after that big disturbance. I mean, fire is a pretty major disturbance. The underground half did just fine. And some of those seeds, the annual crop seeds came up just fine. And the berries came back stronger than ever and better flavored than ever. Disturbance is okay. You just have to minimize it and use it where it makes sense, which is right. Annual crops.
Well, I am growing mostly annual crops. I do have some perennials, but mostly my perennial crops end up being things that I forage rather than that I intentionally plant.
What are those?
Yeah, we're always curious. Okay, what are those perennial crops?
I know you've got different ones than we do.
So my favorite foraging crop is lamb's quarters.
Oh, we love mm-hmm. that.
And I also eat a lot of amaranth, and I collect viola leaves and flowers and like the wild parsleys.
We have the first three here. I don't know about the wild parsleys. Where most of our listeners are has a lot of the wild violas
and the amaranth
and berries and amaranth and lamb's quarters. If you don't do a little disturbance or bring in some compost from somewhere, you're not going to get as much of it. But I had some soil brought in and the lamb's quarters and amaranth were all over the place, and I got some really good ones.
The other things that I really like foraging are the wild berries, service berries, currants, mulberries. Those are the ones that are most common here.
We have wild apple trees. They're not, apples are tricky here. We've got every pest in the book. I'm excited to try to start an apple seed project to find things that are more resistant because it's really tricky in the Northeast where most
yes.
of the issues are.
We have a lot of feral apples here too, and some of them are immune to the local like coddling moths and things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know what that is or why.
Your book is so beautiful and colorful.
And thank you.
It has these great photographs. You talk a lot about community collaboration, that's what makes a landrace gardening really work. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I'm not a very good farmer. I'm not a very good seed saver. But because I live in a community, when I lose my seeds and the mice get in and eat them, or I have a meltdown in a relationship and my woman gets all the seeds, or all those kinds of things happen. But if I'm living in a community and cooperating with the community, when those kinds of things happen, the seeds are just there. They come back to me. And the other thing that is really helpful about working in a community is when I take my squash to the farmer's market, I have agreements with the people that buy my stuff that if they find something that tastes amazing, they bring the seeds back to me. And they're not seed savers. The seeds come back in all kinds of funny configurations and shapes, but they're still viable. And so I can plant them. And then the whole community ends up cooperating and choosing for the varieties that they love. And when I take my stuff to the farmer's market, my customers can really tell me what they like, what they don't like. The university did a survey of my customers and asked, why do you buy Joseph's produce? And I was thinking, oh, because it's local, because it's organic, you know, all these fantasies that a farmer has. And what people actually said that they enjoyed was they bought my stuff for the flavor.
How
would I know that? Because I just eat my own food and it's always tastes wonderful. But if I start comparing what I grow to what the grocery store grows, then it's like, oh, duh, of course, that's why they're buying from me. And so when I started saving my own seeds, that flavor component really jumped leaps and bounds forward. Because if something is really happy growing in my ecosystem, then it just tastes better.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. It sounds wonderful.
Let's get into a little more details. If you find something really good, and the temptation for many listeners would be, okay, I'm going to isolate that and keep it from crossing. Do you do some of that other than with peppers, or do you mostly let it continue to cross? When you get, say, a really good tasting butternut or muskmelon?
So my personal strategy is I always like crossing and I always dislike inbreeding. But if I'm growing 50 squash plants and one of them has a flavor that's just amazing to me or a shape that's amazing or a color that I really like, I might save a packet of that seed separate and plant more of that next year. But I'm also going to save seeds from the other 50 plants and plant them as well, because I want to avoid inbreeding as much as possible, and I want to encourage the cross-pollination. Pollination is a highly localized event. A plant is super likely to either be self-pollinated or pollinated by its closest neighbor, and it's much less likely to be pollinated by plants that are further away. So if I plant one end of the row with my super favorite variety, then it will mostly cross-pollinate with its siblings that are also from that super lovely variety. And then there might be a little bit of pollen that comes in from further away in the row.
Right. So you don't get too much quote-unquote contamination, but really you're getting a little bit of diversity staying in that race.
Right.
Yeah. You just have to change your mindset if you've been saving seeds a different way or not saving seeds a different way.
See, the other thing that happens when we allow cross-pollination is we can let go of all of those rules that the seed-saving people want to put on you, like minimum number of plants, and you can't ever allow anything to cross-pollinate. You have to have these huge isolation distances. Anyway, but all those rules can sort of go bye-bye.
And if you want to make sure you have a large number of plants, you plant really close, right? That's one of your other methods, is you'll do a sort of a crowded planting just for the cross-pollination, especially in the beginning. Is that right?
Right, exactly. Because all I need really is for cross-pollination to be happening or for trials to be happening. For example, people used to send me hundreds of tomato packets of seeds a year. I don't want to grow those. They're junk because they're from far away, long ago. They're not suitable for my garden. I already know I have a 95% failure rate for any tomato that I plant from outside of my garden. But I would take a pinch of those, say 50 seeds in one pot, plant that 50 seeds, transplant them out into one hole in the ground, and see if anything survived. So that was an easy way to try lots of different varieties of tomatoes without using a lot of space or a lot of labor.
Mm-hmm. What are your best tomatoes?
The best tomatoes for me are my own varieties, but I trialed maybe 300 varieties of tomatoes. And one that I got from a fellow up in Canada was called Jagodka, which is a Russian variety. That was the best tomato I ever grew. It was about a saladette size. It was the earliest tomato ever in my garden. Everything that I'm currently growing is a descendant from that tomato in one way or another.
Oh, that's fantastic. Is that because you have that harsh climate, very similar to what they probably have up in Russia?
I have a very short growing season and it's very cool, which when the coolness tends to match the growing season in Russia. But where my climate is different than Russia is I have these huge variations in temperature between day and night. That's the difference between my place in Russia.
So let's walk through some particular crop that and how you did it. I think Jay mentioned the first, second, and third year. Let's talk about the melons.
My mouth is watering just thinking about those melons that you said were so delicious.
Melons are a good crop. Originally, when I decided I was going to start growing melons, by melons, I mean cantaloupes, I purchased 30 varieties of seed from anywhere I could get them. They were modern hybrids, they were old-fashioned heirlooms, they were open-pollinated varieties, and I just planted them in my garden, one packet of seeds after another. And about 80% of the varieties that I planted either got eaten by bugs before they germinated, or they grew meagerly and didn't produce a fruit, or they grew and they produced a fruit just before frost. But every fruit that I collected that year was a green fruit. There wasn't a single fruit that matured in my garden. But I just saved all the seeds, planted them, and the second year, I planted about 200 seeds, and there were two plants out of that 200 that did better than every other cantaloupe that I planted. And those two plants produced more than the whole rest of the patch combined. And they just grew vigorously from the very beginning. You know, you could tell right from when they were seedlings that they were out competing everything else. And so then the third year, I planted seeds from everything, but mostly from those two plants that had produced abundantly. And the third year, they were just thriving, just tremendous growth and vigor. And they matured super early. So not only was I taking them to market, but I was taking them to market for like 3, 4, 5 weeks. So just beautiful, glorious plants.
When do they ripen over there?
They ripen mid-August. The 1st of August eventually is when I started harvesting them in abundance. I plant them about the last week of May or the first week of June.
So that's pretty quick.
If
Let's have a little
someone
contact information. If someone wanted to get in touch with you or hear your podcast, Joseph Lofthouse, author of Landrace Gardening, how would they do that?
So my podcast is available on any of the major podcasting sites, and that's Going to Seed Podcast.
Going to Seed podcast.
And I also have a community that I cooperate with that made a video course about my book. So we filmed for several weeks and then they made a course about it. And that's at goingtoseed.org. There's also there a farmer support program. Landrace seeds are available. We have a community where we collaborate with each other on breeding projects and seed sharing. You can join my mailing list at lofthouse.com. I send out a newsletter maybe once a month or whenever something important comes along. And my books are available wherever books are sold,
Including from your
Amazon,
website, right?
Barnes and Noble, from my website. I'm a little bit tardy sometimes about books you get from my website because it's so hard to keep them in stock. I sold like 7,000 copies already.
Wow.
From a little,
Congratulations.
thank you, a little podunk farmer from nowhere in Utah.
That's
That's
wonderful.
great. Okay, so we're
With Joseph Lofthouse, author of Landrace Gardening, Food Security Through Biodiversity and Promiscuous Pollination.
thank you, Jay.
I like saying that. I want to say it three times fast.
Well, see, I had to choose the term promiscuous pollination because in the seed industry, there's this idea of open pollination. When people hear that intuitively, they think, oh, we don't really know who's the daddy and things are crossing. But no, what happened with the seed industry is when they say open pollinated, that means they did everything they could possibly do to keep it from actually crossing.
Oh,
and it means they're
I didn't
not
know that.
They're not hybrids. They're not a controlled cross either.
Right.
There's something that they just take whatever variety you ended up with, like say your favorite muskmelon, and just isolated it and planted that over and over and over and over again, generation after generation.
Correct. Inbreeding it over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And when I started trying to grow up in my high elevation ecosystem that's not like any other ecosystem in the country, the open pollinated varieties didn't work for me because they're so inbred that they couldn't adapt to my climate, and they were developed for climates that are far away and long ago.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And you talk a little bit about some of the terms heirloom and open pollinated. You just mentioned hybrid and heirloom, and hybrids are good and heirlooms are good. And
oh, so some of the hybrids are made with male sterile plants. That trait is passed on through the mother only. And so all of the offspring end up being male sterile as well. They don't produce pollen. So in my mind, that isn't a trait that I want to encourage in my garden.
It's a trait that seed companies want to encourage to keep selling seed every year, but that's about the best thing about it.
Right.
Is that deliberate, or is it just the nature of how the genetics?
Well, it makes it really inexpensive to make hybrids.
Uh-huh.
And because it's inexpensive and easy, and then they also get the benefit of you have to buy your seed every single year. It has a couple of advantages to the seed companies.
Right. So that's the trouble with hybrids. The good thing about hybrids versus some of the open pollinated is that you get at least a little genetic diversity back in. So
correct.
Your plants might be a little more robust, but again, it's hard. You can't save seed from it, apparently.
I really like saving seeds from hybrid plants of anything that has big seeds, like the corn and the squash, even the tomatoes, because they have some genetic diversity in them, and you can find some nice stuff that's coming out of them. But any of the little micro-seeded things that people aren't making by hand pollination, they tend to have that male sterile trait.
Oh, okay. So some of the bigger seeds may not have that male sterile trait.
Uh-huh.
I think I got rumpled, wrinkled, curly cress, and I didn't know if it was a hybrid, but maybe it wasn't because I get two offspring. And to this day, I'm getting a curly leaf, lacy leaf one, and a broader leaf, wrinkly leaf one. And I think the original one was something in between those two. I don't know if it reverted to something like the parents, but I just keep saving that seed and I get pretty similar things. Everyone's a little different, how lacy it is or how curly and broadleaf it is. It varies.
And they all grow together.
Yeah.
Right next to each other.
How beautiful.
It's a sweet cress. And I thought that was a hybrid, but maybe it wasn't. Apparently it wasn't male sterile in that case.
Yeah. Well, there are other methods of making hybrids, but it's really confusing to try to figure out for every particular species what the method of making the hybrid was.
Was, yeah.
The easy way to tell that is to look at the flowers, because most of the plants that are male sterile will lack anthers. So the flower will just be missing the anthers, and so you can see visually.
Great.
I'm learning so much here. I'm sorry. I'm just like taking notes to beat the band. But that's a good reason to have the book, which we do have.
Sweet.
And if
well, thank you for your support.
Yeah. You talked about the steps you did, I think, for muskmelons.
For particular
crops. Is there another crop we want to talk about?
I could share about a squash that I was working with. So I was growing Burgess Buttercup. So it's just a squash that maybe weighs 3 pounds, and it was green. And I was growing that for years, and I enjoyed it. And one year, I planted it in the same field as red curry squash. And so a little bit of pollen from the red curry came and got onto my buttercup. So the next generation, I had a squash that looked like a buttercup, except it had red stripes on it. And I'm like, whoa, that's exciting. And so I started saving the buttercups that were red and green. So they were those two colors. About 3 or 4 years later, I had a squash called Hopi White that was growing in the same field, and it sent some of its pollen over. And so then I got squash that were the green and red, except they were also pink and they call it blue, I think, just the really light green. And so all of a sudden, I had four different colors of squash that were all growing in my buttercup. And every year I selected for my buttercup flavor, because I don't like the flavor of red curry at all. And I selected for the buttercup shape. I kept a buttercup squash, but the skin color changed a little bit over the years. And so that was an example of a gradual, slow development of a landrace.
And how are they today? Are they?
Oh, they're a beautiful squash. And so the way that I plant them today is I'll save seeds from the orange ones and I'll plant them on one end of the row. I'll save seeds from the green ones, plant them on the other end of the row. I'll save seeds from the light green ones, plant them on the end of another row. And then the light pink ones, I'll plant them on another end of the row. So they mostly stay to themselves. But they also do the crossing back and forth where the rows are close together.
And so, do you find them a very hardy crop?
Yes, they are my earliest winter squash because every year I've selected them for earliness and I have selected them for flavor. And of course, the one thing that I always select for, even though I don't say it, is productivity. Something has to reproduce in my garden before I can save seeds from it. And the more it reproduces, the more likely I am to save seeds from it.
Do we want to talk about the tomato project?
I would love to. So I was trying to breed tomatoes. I was just having a super difficult time breeding tomatoes because they were so inbred as a species that I just didn't have enough genetic material to work with. When tomatoes were originally domesticated, the tomatoes went from South America up to Mexico, a few seeds, and then a few seeds went from Mexico over to Europe, and then a few seeds came from Europe back to the rest of the world. And what that resulted in is the tomatoes lost 95% of their genetic diversity. So the whole population of tomatoes is super inbred. And people get all excited about, oh, all the diversity in these tomatoes. But that diversity is maybe 5 or 10 different genes that we're combining together to get the different kinds of fruit colors and shapes and leaf shapes and whatnot. So one day I was out in my tomato patch and I saw that every time I went to it, I was testing for frost tolerance at the time. And every time I went into the patch to evaluate it, there was one plant that had a bumblebee on it. And so I'm starting to think, what if we could convert tomatoes into a promiscuously pollinating crop? Then all of a sudden, they'd be able to solve for themselves all these problems that I'm trying to solve with poisons and crossing and materials and labor. So I dug deeper into tomatoes and found that there are wild varieties that are 100% outcrossing. They can't pollinate themselves, so they have to be crossing. And if they're crossing, that genetic roulette wheel is spinning really fast, and they can really figure out how to solve their own problems. And so I cross my tomatoes with those wild tomatoes and I'm just having a blast. I call it the Beautifully Promiscuous and Totally Tasty Tomatoes Project. And
And when you find a tomato flower that is crossing, it's big, right? It's a big flower. It looks
yeah,
different.
those flowers can be 2 inches in diameter and they have huge petals, and if you compare them to the little micro flowers that the domestic tomatoes have, the wild flower types can just draw the pollinators in. The flowers are wide open, so the female part of the flower is just right out there to get cross-pollinated with the belly of a bee, and they're just lovely decorative flowers even.
I
How
know.
do
Where do you get
where
those
can you get a
wild tomatoes come from?
so
Big flowered tomato. Yeah.
so we currently have some seeds available at going to seed.org in our yearly seed swap. And I'm also looking for collaborators that would grow some of those out and return seeds. I have only about 500 seeds left for this year that I could share with people. There is a possibility that for the right person, I could share seeds as well. I'm particularly looking for collaborators in ecosystems with a lot of blight or diseases
Oh boy, that sounds
because,
like us.
well, but
Woohoo!
the seed is currently a little bit limited, but I've hired a few people to grow seeds out for me this year. And so hopefully by next year, I'll have enough seed that we can share it widely. I made some mistakes early on in this project because I was treating the tomatoes like they were inbreeding when they're actually outcrossing. And so I had to retrain myself. I had to retrain my collaborators that these really are a different species, a different way of growing tomatoes.
You were talking about how they came from South America and they came to Mexico and some went to Europe. Do you have people that bring you back seeds from any of the places like South America?
I ended up getting seeds from a seed bank in Germany.
Oh, wow.
So some explorer went down to South America and brought seeds back and shared them with me. And there are some varieties that are available in the commercial seed market from small sole proprietor kind of seed companies
Right.
that,
Yeah.
I was thinking more like a friend who went down to South America and, dare I say, smuggled? Just to see what you would do with.
Well, technically, it's not illegal for someone to send me seeds without my permission.
Ah, great. So you've heard it. Joseph does not give anyone permission to send him seeds.
Especially not from promiscuous tomatoes.
Yeah.
My garden was actually raided by the USDA one time because they said someone sent me a seed.
You're kidding. Did they find what they were looking for?
Well, no.
Jeez. That's so
They
absurd.
couldn't figure out which seed it was.
Well, I get thousands of seed packets a year. How would I possibly know which one is
Right.
came from overseas?
Really? We haven't talked about,
Garlic.
yes, we haven't talked about garlic. Okay, go ahead.
No, but you had something else in mind.
Well, I listen, I'm half Italian, so garlic takes precedence over everything.
It turns out that garlic has been cloned for so many millennia that most of the garlic plants that we grow have forgotten how to make seeds. And when I talk about garlic seeds, I mean the actual botanical seeds that were formed by an ova and a pollen. And
They'll be black. They'll look like onion seed rather than little bulbils, which are clones, right?
exactly. Thank you for saying that. And
Oh, I didn't know that.
yeah, and so we found out that there's about 10% of garlic varieties that are still capable of making seeds, and they might make two or three seeds per flower head, and the seeds might only germinate at 5 or 10%. Because every time a crop is cloned, it gets a little bit of genetic damage in the clone. And so those accumulate over the years. So we figured out that you can get some of those garlics, which are like the marbled purple stripe is the one that we've been most successful with. And a variety I like is called chestnut red, which has a really good reputation for making seeds. And if you take those and you grow enough of them and plant enough of them, they will start growing garlic. And the garlic can become locally adapted because the genetics are changing. Also, when you start growing garlic from seeds, it repairs that genetic damage. So in the second and third generation, you start getting more seeds per plant. The seeds are germinating more effectively. So you can really select for garlics that are locally adapted.
Wow.
And I'm on about my third generation of doing that. And the way I found that it works best to plant the seeds is to plant them outside during the winter, sprinkle the seeds on the ground in a place that's not going to grow a lot of weeds. So typically what I do is I put a 2 or 3 inches of weed-free soil onto a spot. And it also helps if you cover them, like if you plant them on the floor of a greenhouse that's unheated or underneath a little cover of some kind or other, a cold frame. Then you can get garlics that really thrive for you instead of just kind of eking out an existence in your garden.
Yeah. And there is a trick to doing it, though, because when it sends up what's called a garlic scape, it will then open up into maybe what's a flower, but usually it's mostly bulbils. So don't you have to remove the bulbils the first two generations?
Well, see, what the bulbils do is they expand and they crush the flower stalk.
Right.
And so if you remove those, then there's more likelihood that the flower stalk will stay viable. Some varieties can produce seeds even if you don't remove the bulbils, but they'll produce more seeds if you do remove them. And so it's, you know, how much labor do you want to put in as right. opposed to how happy-go-lucky you want to be?
Mm-hmm. I just thought for jump-starting it, because I don't remember seeing garlic seed happen on any of my garlics. I didn't let too many of them go, though, so I'm going to do that this year.
I'd like to see that.
Especially any of them that are the purple stripe varieties.
I love those.
Yeah.
Let me ask this question, because you would know. How's the flavor in comparison with the ones that don't produce seed?
Every plant is going to have a different flavor.
Okay.
And so you can choose for a hotter flavor, a milder flavor, a more savory variety. There's a lot of diversity. One thing that we learned is that a lot of the varieties of garlic that people are growing are actually genetically identical. And people just have given it dozens of different names over the years.
We've been hearing music a lot.
And music is one of those varieties that has 30 different names.
Wow.
We'll never tire of making something simple difficult.
Have you done anything with perennial crops? A little thing that said landrace chicken.
I grow my landrace chickens. I make it easy for myself by bringing a new rooster in every generation so that the daddy isn't reproducing with his offspring. And that has worked really well for me. So I basically keep the locally adapted hens. The rooster can be whatever happens to be available. Although I have neighbors that also keep chickens landrace style. And so sometimes I get a rooster from them. And I grow fruit trees, planting them from seed and seeing what survives and what tastes good. And that's a little longer project, but we're currently on the fourth generation of my walnut breeding program, which started before I was born.
Wow.
What kind of walnuts are they?
A Carpathian, the English walnut.
Mm-hmm.
Delicious.
Named after the English ranch, not after England, apparently. I think it was a California ranch.
Okay.
But I'm sure they were from Asia also, Carpathian. I used to just do Moscata, cross the different Moscatas. And then I started letting Maximas cross. I'm talking squash now.
Okay, yeah, we're on the
four squash.
Squash
families. I started letting the Maximas cross and had good luck with that, but I was afraid to do Pepos because I was afraid my zucchinis would cross with the sweet squash and I'd get something not so great. When I was a kid, we had something called monster squash, which was a cross between yellow crookneck and South African squash. So we had that cross and it was bigger than both parents. I don't know how it happened, but it was these huge, huge yellow bumpy things that would be like a foot and a half long.
Uh-huh.
Came from these little tiny African squash. So anyway, do you cross Pepos at all, that family?
So yes, I do, but I tend to keep the zucchini types together. I don't care if the skin of it is white or green or striped or yellow or dark green, as long as it looks like a long, skinny zucchini. And I also grow together the delicata and the acorn squash as a winter squash.
Mm-hmm.
The two things I care about in that crop are productivity and does it taste fantastic? I spent years not working with the Pepo winter squash because I thought they tasted nasty. And then I'm like, oh, duh. I'm a plant breeder. I save seeds from what tastes fantastic to me. So for the last 5 years, I've been saving the seeds for delicata and acorn and selecting for flavor. And I recently went on a book tour and I was giving out squash while I went on my trip. And people kept telling me it's the best delicata squash I ever tasted in my whole life. And I'm like, oh, duh, why didn't I do this 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
Wow.
Well, you couldn't have picked better tasting squash to do that. Delicatas are, oh, so wonderful.
Well, see, delicata got a bad reputation about 20 years ago because the farmer that was growing it for the whole country allowed a poisonous wild gourd to grow in his field. Ooh. And so about, I don't know, one in a couple hundred delicata squash ended up being poisonous and tasting nasty. Ooh. And so it ruined the reputation of the delicata squash for decades after that.
Wow.
And I've had delicata that are not so great and ones that are really delicious. I don't know if some of that genetics got in there. I hope I wasn't poisoned.
You would know if it was so bad that you had to spit it out, then that's the poison. Yeah. At least squash poison is well behaved and it tells you that you're getting poisoned ahead of time.
Not like a deadly, what, an Amanita or a destroying mushroom.
Oh, yeah, or the nightshades are really bad about not giving you fair warning.
Oh, they can look good and take a bite. And I want to talk a little bit about pests and diseases.
I welcome pests and diseases into my garden because they are training my plants how to be strong. I don't want a squash in my garden that's going to be susceptible to disease. And so any disease that's in my garden is really helpful and beneficial because the only thing that's going to survive it is what can survive it.
That's such a great attitude. I love that, you know, because it does make it so much simpler. It's like this plant can't handle this. It's going to go by the wayside. So the one next to it's doing well, we're going to get those seeds and go on with it.
Right. Can I give an example?
Yes.
So, in the tomato growing forums, people are saying, oh, my tomato has blossom end rot. What can I do? And I'm like, my tomatoes never have blossom end rot. Because if you have blossom end rot, don't you know you're a bad farmer? Because you didn't water right. You didn't put enough calcium on in the right way. You blah, blah. And you did this and you did this and bad farmer, bad farmer, bad farmer. And I'm like, no, I'm a good farmer. And any plant that has blossom end rot in my garden, even one time anywhere in the growing season, I just yank it out by the roots. And I never, ever again have a blossom end rot problem.
I'm writing that down, you know. You probably put that in your book, but it's worth saying again. Yank that plant out.
I don't know if I did or not.
I love
you said
that.
It, you said it about other things, that you would rogue out things that couldn't take the conditions, who didn't want it setting seed.
Well, I won't mention any names, but I'm related by marriage to a gentleman who believes that all things are worth saving at the risk of staying up nights. And I love this.
But I don't save seeds from the bad guys.
Yeah, but often I've had the impulse to get it out of there. Thank you.
Well, if I have any message at all, it's go ahead and follow your impulses and get it out of there.
Yes. You know, Bill's never going to allow me in the garden again.
I will. And don't blame yourself for what's actually a genetic fault in the seeds.
That's a really good thing. That's a really good thing to hear.
Well, I was a little more forgiving of kale because there's a certain time of year when the aphids would get really bad. But even then, there were plants that didn't have any aphids. So I can always rogue out those aphid-covered plants.
Right.
What I'm afraid of happening is if I pull them out and all the aphids land on the ground, they're just going to have fun on somebody else. And hopefully they're resistant. They won't have too much fun.
Right.
Well, I have appreciated talking with you. I so appreciate all the information. We could talk to you for a lot longer, but I know that time is running out. So I want to give out your contact information again.
If you can give it out. Kind. Yeah.
Yes, if you'd give it out.
So best place to get hold of me is goingtoseed.org is where I spend most of my time online. And you can join my mailing list at lofthouse.com or get autographed copies of my book there. Also, my book's available wherever books are sold. Goingtoseed.org.
Which I just love.
Goingtoseed.org. Great.
And again, it's been a pleasure having you on. And I hope that we'll get to see you one of these days.
Yeah.
And it's late August and he's got all those melons.
All right.
Big foodies.
And there will be a review of your book that I was asked to write, which is how I found out about you. And I said, oh my God, we got to have this guy on the radio. Well, for the Natural Farmer, the Northeast Organic Farming Association.
Oh, yes.
Newspaper. So
thank you, Bill. Thank you, Jay.
Oh, you're so
thank
welcome,
you.
Joseph. Our pleasure. And hope to be seeing you again soon or listening to you on your podcast.
Sweet. Thank you.
All righty.
Thanks. Take good care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
I just spent a little time at goingtoseed.org. And it's a wonderful resource. There are a number of discussions. There's a training course. There are groups in different parts of the country. We have a little extra time, so I'm going to talk a little bit about pruning. First of all, the tools for pruning would be a bypass pruner rather than an anvil type to avoid crushing the branches. A good lopper and a pole lopper or a pole pruner that doesn't have the saw and a separate saw is better than trying to manage something with both the lopper and the saw with a rope on it. It's really hard to manage that one. For tall trees, the three-legged orchard ladders are the best. The first thing to consider is not pruning at all, and what would that cause? You also want to look online and see how trees respond to different pruning cuts before you start pruning. Don't take any more than 30% of the tree. You'll get an overly robust response from the tree, creating a lot of unnecessary work later. You want to do the big cuts first to open up the tree. If you have a tree that hasn't been pruned in a long time, don't do everything the first year. Do it over a few years. I prefer thinning cuts over tipping cuts. What tipping causes when you cut the tip of a branch is you get a multi-shoot response. 3, 4, 5 little branches come out on the side. Only do this when you need more branches in a particular part of the tree, and you can follow up next year thinning the several ones that you will not want, believe me. Imagine how the tree will grow in future years. In a humid climate with limited sun, you want to do more thinning of the interior so that the limited sun can ripen interior fruits. Apples and pears, late February to March. You can do it as late as early April in the coldest microclimates. And it's okay to chop up prunings and leave as a mulch. The only exception might be fire-blighted branches that you could remove from the area. But more ramial wood chips, mulching, compost on the surface can help boost tree health. And there are many other things you can do. Look up Michael Phillips' holistic orcharding,
or Nigel Palmer has a book on homemade garden amendments, things that you can do to increase your tree's resistance to disease and pest and other problems. You could also bring in varieties that are resistant to some of those diseases. You can also do a mass selection project along the lines of what we just talked about in the show with Joseph Lofthouse. Look up Mark Shepard, and Joseph Lofthouse also does it. You plant a huge number of apple seed genetics and select for precociousness, and then later for other traits. But the first thing is you want to get fast fruit so that you can do this breeding project over your lifetime. Make sure they've been cold stored long enough to break dormancy, and then just plant as many seeds as you can. This is WBCRLP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org, where you can also make a donation to support this station. Thank you.